Hey everybody, how are you guys doing? I'm Colleen Fabry and this is Venture Europe. Venture Europe is a series of conversations with successful entrepreneurs, investors, and ecosystem contributors where we discuss about the strategies, tactics, frameworks, and failings that they have used and experienced during their journey. It is my personal vendetta to contribute in making Europe one of the most attractive entrepreneurial ecosystems in the world. Big words, hard work, so let's get started. My guest today is Ulrich Musse, the founder of Vauban. Vauban is a venture capital platform that makes it easy for investors and VCs to launch their funds, SPVs, and syndicates. Over $1 billion has been invested via Vauban's platform since its launch. Ulrich is an angel investor as well as an entrepreneur with a keen passion for supporting the venture capital ecosystem. During this episode, we discuss what led Ulrich to becoming an entrepreneur, the ups and downs of entrepreneurship, and Vauban's mission. Let's go and talk with Ulrich. Let's start with the story of when and where the idea of Vauban was born. And the evolution from a tiny idea in your head into an actual business.
Yeah, so I mean, I've always been, you know, launching like startup and projects since I was very young, you know, on my parents' computer, and then I went studying business finance, software engineering. That's where I met my current co-founder, and together we kept on, you know, building things. I mean, our first startup was a fashion marketplace, some kind of Tinder, but for fashion. And it was a really fun experience, but we quickly realized it was not our thing, you know, fashion. Like, we were the least fashionable people at uni. You know, we always dress with, like, you know, boring white shirt every day. So it was just not our thing. And after that, we wanted to launch a VC fund because we thought we knew software quite well, you know, by reading like a TechCrunch, etc. You know, talking with lawyers and accountants and bankers, we realized it was a very complex process. So that's where the idea came from. We were like, you know, we can improve the process, because when you think about it, when you are a fund manager, you want two things in life. You want to raise money and deploy capital into startups. But you don't want to have to deal with, you know, legal document, accounting, regulation, investor onboarding, reporting, etc. So we came up with, you know, a simple idea, right? Like a platform to make it really easy to launch and run VC funds, syndicate, and SPVs. 4 years ago, we released a landing page with like a simple messaging, the easiest way to set up your fund. And we had so many, requests from a potential client, etc. And I remember I was in my hometown in Lyon, in France back then. And we were like, okay, we have to do this, right? Like, there is just so many people interested in this concept. So we moved to London because that makes more sense for like a fintech. And yeah, and that's how we got started, basically. And 4 years after, now we have like 250 fund managers on the platform. So, you know, instead of launching one fund, now we help 250 fund managers. So it was a pretty, cool evolution from, you know, the first like idea to an actual business.
Super cool. And what led you down the path of entrepreneurship? You mentioned that you were tinkering with a computer, with your parents' computer, and then you always had different ideas that you would want to start. Like, what would you attribute this to?
Yeah, it's a funny question, because there was not like a defining moment. Like, all was done pretty gradually. I remember, I would always use, you know, my parents' computer to learn how to code, to learn Photoshop by, like, you know, going to online forums, you know, that would teach you how to become like a designer or stuff like that. And I was mind blowing, right? That you could learn essentially everything online, right? My first project, I was on a forum, and one guy posted this topic. Like, he was looking for a designer to design like his logo. He had like a maritime company, like a shipping, you know, company. You know, on Photoshop, for those who know Photoshop, you have like predefined icon. So I took an icon, like a predefined icon of an anchor, and I basically just add a text underneath, and I ship it to the client. And he was really happy about it. You know, he was really, really happy. And that's how I made my first like invoice, right? 100 euro. That's the beauty of internet, right? Like, he had no idea. I was just a, you know, 12 years old boy in front of a computer, like designing his stuff. So that was my first invoice. I kept on, you know, building like bigger website. So one of them was, my first one was called Scribios. It was a community for writers and readers to share fan fiction. So similar to Wattpad. And same, like I hired, you know, a graphic designer and beta testers found on online forums. I've never, you know, spoke to them because I didn't want them to find out I was, you know, I was only 13. It was all funded through my, you know, pocket money from my parents, like €20 a month. One day I was invited to a networking event about like online books industry in Paris. So I asked my parents to, you know, take me there. And it was so awkward, right? Because all of the people were like, you know, in their 30s and I had to lie about my age. It was a very awkward moment. And the cherry on the top, it was all in English. So you can imagine, right? Like my English is not great right now, but like back then it was basically non-existent. I think people were not understanding anything. So yeah, it was just, yeah, gradually. Then I did an online game as well called Mini War. And yeah, one of the funny moments on this project one was when essentially the game had just reached like 50,000 users and there was just a lot of like bugs and the code base, you know, was starting to become completely unmanageable. One day, one guy found a way to exploit like a bug that basically ruins the entire economy of the game. I was at a theater, like, you know, watching a movie with my parents, and I had to run to the bathroom, shut down the servers, and the community was so pissed off. Like, they asked me to basically leave the game, you know, to give my kind of resignation, which was very dumb, right? But the only thing I found was to impersonate myself, create kind of a new identity. And I sent a, you know, a statement like, I'm selling the game to another guy so he can build like a better infrastructure, etc. But that was myself.
Oh, that's amazing.
I regained their confidence, etc. But that was a true hustle, really.
I love you saying that, right? Because I think in the minds of a lot of people listening and also in the general population, they see entrepreneurship as there's something that, you know, it's very complex. You have to wait, you have to plan, you have to spend like a lot of money, a lot of months, right? But I think it's also quite visible how you started, you know, oh, look, someone needs a logo. You know, I can just like figure out and be like a scrappy entrepreneur and kind of do something and make money. And once you see how that actually you can create something that someone finds valuable, you know, that's in a sense entrepreneurship at a very, very small scale, right? But then also in the same token, you know, you had this idea to build a fund, you saw that the problem is there, and you said, okay, we want to solve this problem because probably a lot of the funds have this problem. You moved to London. So tell me what happens next? You know, how has the first year as a founder?
I mean, it was a roller coaster for sure. How would I divide it? I think the first quarter, the focus was really on winning the first client. So, you know, we didn't think about, you know, let's start fundraising, right? Like a pre-seed round, 2-3 million, and then we're going to build a product and then we're going to sell the product. So the real focus was on just win one client because we had basically, you know, limited resources, right? We had almost no money. And it's very hard to convince someone to buy your product when there is no product, right? Like you, even if you work on your sales pitch and you are the best salesman on earth, there is no way someone is going to buy it, right? So you just need to, yeah, take, you know, 100, 200 calls and find someone that is going to trust you personally, right? It needs to resonate really, like your personality needs to resonate. And it's not a question of, yeah, of sales pitch or anything. You just need to keep going until, you know, you find this person that is going to trust you. Like, it's really similar to finding your first investors, right? Like, you need to just spend like countless hours with, you know, meeting with investors, etc., until someone trusts you. And then next quarter, it was about like actually building the, you know, the product and deliver the outcome to our first clients. And essentially we are what we call a full stack startup. So a full stack startup, essentially, it's not a pure software company. So you can think about Apple, for example, where they do software, but they do as well the hard bit, right? Like the hardware. Or Uber, like they build the software, but they need to find like drivers, etc. So there is an operational aspect to it where you need to actually do the work. And in our case, we had to do the accounting for the funds. We had to do the legal document, draft the legal document, etc. So we had to essentially design, because it was never been done before, right? What we are doing. So we had to design the playbook on how we're going to build this product. Of course, our ultimate mission is to automate everything. But at the beginning, you can't, because, you know, it's just like two people in a basement, right? So it was about designing the playbook. And what we did was to first outsource everything and do things manually with like a service provider. So a law firm, an accountant, etc. Learn how they do it and then do it ourselves better. And then we automate it with tech. So that's how we started thinking about the playbook on all the future product we're going to launch. And then rest of the year, it was making our first hires. So that was the most unforeseen challenge that I faced. It was certainly the hiring. Because when you are on the other side, so, you know, when you apply for a job, you think the employer, like the company, has a lot of options, right? And there are so many people that apply. And actually, the hard job is to be the company, because essentially we realized there was a true talent competition, and you really have to sell like the company hardcore, like to attract the talents you want. And hiring is such a broken concept, right? That just after a couple of discussion, you are supposed to make a judgment, you know, on the future, like 5 years of performance of someone. Like, it was just a very hard thing to do. And it's funny because I remember our early discussion with my co-founder, and for each role we wanted to hire, we were like, oh my God, this role, it's impossible to find, because we want a lawyer that is able to understand venture capital, but that is able as well to code, you know, contracts, etc. And we're like, it's impossible to find. But in fact, every role is very hard to find, just because it's driven by like, you know, the law of supply and demand. So it's very difficult to find, you know, a software engineer. All roles essentially are very difficult. There is no free lunch.
Yeah. How did your role as a founder change? So you are now like in year four. How did your role change? And what are the most difficult things now? Still hiring, I would assume, or but also other stuff.
So I guess every time, you know, the team doubles, your job changes, right? So in the beginning, when there are like just, you know, four or five people, the job is really to get as much as possible done yourself, right? To survive. And then when you double and it's like 10 people, you need to put in place, you know, some processes and start being a bit more, you know, hands off. And then now it's really to make, you know, myself redundant, right? Like really create this kind of autonomous organization, because it's the most satisfying thing to watch when things go well without any intervention from your side, right? Like, let's say, you know, we decide to launch a new product and you tell the team and the product is a success. Like it's the most beautiful, you know, without any of your input, it's the most beautiful things to see, because it means that you have built, you know, the right infrastructure so that people can thrive, can have ideas, you know, can be on power and can make, you know, a bigger impact than yourself. Yeah, it's really my focus now.
Got it. I would like us just to go back a little bit, because there is a question on my mind, and is that first meeting with the first client. I just can't take it out of the way. Because I definitely understand how important it's like the first meeting, like with the first client. Like, do you remember the first meeting and how did that connection? And also, of course, if you want to give a shout out, you know, like to the company, I do believe that the first one that do trust you is just, they give you so much, you know, that trust, that saying yes. And trusting in you.
No, I remember very precisely our first meeting. So it was the first day I arrived to London. So I had just, you know, like we were in this Airbnb with like 8 people. We woke up at like 7 a.m. The meeting was at 8 a.m. We were in a WeWork with, like, you know, no office, but we had like rent like a meeting room for the occasion. And so the client arrives and there was a meeting plan, etc., with like a demo of, you know, like the beta version of the product. It was an hour meeting, and one of our advisor, I mean our only advisor actually at the time, went to that meeting as well to help us to to sell. So it was very awkward, right? Because we were in the room and then the advisor show up, which is very strange, right? In a meeting. But we deliver our, you know, our speech. And in the last 5 minutes of the meeting, the client, he was like a quantitative trader that wanted to launch a hedge fund. And he was like, you know, I flew like to London for, you know, to meet you guys, but to shop around as well with different service provider and different law firms. And the proposal and the speech that you just presented is the best one. It was just mind blowing, right? Because we, Because essentially, you know, it was a true confirmation that we were on the good direction, right? Because we basically, you know, beat the competition of like, you know, law firm with like 100 years of existence just by having the, you know, the right idea. I think it resonated as well very well with him because, you know, it was a quantitative fund. So he really wanted like a tech platform, etc. And he was a bit bored with like, you know, all the lawyers and the fancy dinners, etc. So I think the value proposition really resonated well. So yeah, we got lucky on that one.
Love the story. Love the story. I do assume that you guys had a very nice celebration that day or like the end of the week before kind of...
Yeah, no, it was the best feeling, honestly, like, you know, when you receive like the first check, right? The first invoice, because it was more than 100 euro. So yeah, it was a good feeling.
So from the first client, now you also mentioned you have 250, if I remember correctly, like 250 managers on the platform. Well done. What keeps you up at night? Yeah.
So the thing about the space we are in, that there are so many directions we can explore and so many opportunities. So we can expand like, in terms of new geographies, you know, launch maybe the Singapore or launch the US, so we can explore that. Or we can launch, you know, new products, or we can maybe develop products for investors versus fund manager, which is like the natural path. Or we can, you know, build something where people can, you know, can raise money on our platform. So there are plenty of different opportunities. And because I think founders are so trained, like to seize opportunities, you know, immediately when they arise, there is this tendency of like, you know, keep chasing the new, you know, the new shiny object versus focusing on your core product. And even if you read everywhere, right, that the focus is key, it's been in all podcasts, it's been in all books or articles about entrepreneurship that you need to focus to win. It's very hard actually when you are in the business to demonstrate focus. You know, it's my questioning of the moment, right? And it's a difficult balance to strike, but are we enough focused on our core product or is it time, you know, to start expanding?
Interesting. Love that. And what does the future of venture investing look like? Just a little bit of background to the question. I remember when I talked with Sebastian Malabi, and he was telling me that when venture capital was created in 1970s, it was called liberation capital. And it was called liberation capital because it will liberate the brains from the corporates. But it kind of seems that what you're doing is, again, a form of liberating capital to be formed. So you're liberating capital to be formed and deployed more easily.
It's a beautiful story. I didn't know about it. I'm going to steal you that. I think venture investing will become more accessible. I really see a world, you know, where everyone angel invests, you know, like everyone now, like people, you know, buy stocks on the stock market thanks to free trade or Robinhood. I really see the same thing happening to the world of angel investment. When you buy a stock on the stock market, the money is going to someone else, right? Like the person that just sold the stock. So you have limited impact. Essentially, you just make someone richer. But when you invest in venture, the money is directly going to fund, right? Like the future of the world, right? So I think it's beautiful, really. Like it's a beautiful mission. And that's why I love, you know, doing what I do. And that's why we are here as well at Vauban, right? To build the infrastructure to democratize venture capital. And when you think about it, it's regulation, right, that is holding off this democratization of venture capital. Because, for example, if you are in the UK or in the US, you need to demonstrate like a certain net worth, like more than, you know, 1 million of net worth to be able to invest in venture funds or in venture capital. But it's a bit ridiculous, right? Because, for example, you can go to Las Vegas and spend $10,000, right, on the roulette in a casino, but you can't invest in venture capital. So you have like $200 billion every year that is stolen from people by casino corporation, but this money will be better, you know, invested in VC. So I really, you know, want to push this concept of more than a threshold based on the net worth or how much money you make, kind of a driving license, but to be able to invest in venture capital. So you need to know, you know, about like how to analyze a startup, etc. And if you pass your license of investors, then you can invest in venture capital. Another trend I think that is becoming quite important is ESG, so like, you know, economics, like social and governance. I really think there will be a big shift in how integral ESG will become to the investor world. Because if you look, for example, at you know, PE fund, like private equity funds, now it's all about, you know, ESG. So they're going to ask their portfolio company to report on a lot of, you know, different criteria about, you know, how they treat, you know, their employee in terms of like female, male, etc. Plus, you know, their governance, their impact on the social impact on the world. And ESG is non-existent in the VC world. Like out of, you know, like the 3,000 VC firm worldwide, only a few dozen, right, have made like public commitment to ESG. And why there was this change in private equity is because investors that fund their private equity funds pushed for more, you know, ESG reporting. And I think the same thing is going to happen in the VC world. So I won't be surprised if in like 5 years, when you fundraise, you will have like during the due diligence to report on a few, you know, criteria that is going to be key for the VC to invest in your company.
Mm, I agree. So, and the push will be coming from the limited partner side.
Exactly. I think it's going to come from the limited partner.
Got it. And considering the current macro environment, what would you say to someone that wants to raise a fund now?
Yeah, so it's a bit counterintuitive, but I honestly think it's the best time to start a fund just because the valuation, you know, so low, right? So would you prefer to have started a fund a year ago and to invest at like super high valuation and you will have like a, you know, a bad return? Or would you prefer to invest now where, you know, you have like decent valuation, you have time as well to do your, you know, your due diligence because, you know, a year ago, like deals will be done in a couple of days, right? So it was madness. Now you have, you know, weeks to do your due diligence. So I think it's actually a great time to start a fund. The only thing is that, you know, fundraising on the investor side, on the LP side, is a bit challenging because, you know, they see like venture as like overrated, etc. But when you look at it, essentially when interest rates are high, people, you know, don't want to invest in risky asset class like venture fund. And when interest rates are low, they want to invest. But currently the interest rates are quite low, right? So it's going to take time before interest rates rise. And if you look at inflation, you can't keep your money in cash, right? And if you look at the stock market, it's so volatile that you can't as well invest in the stock market because, you know, a stock will do plus 10 and minus 20, etc. So it's super volatile. So I think as an LP, you really need to invest, you know, in the long term. And that's why I think it's actually a great time to start a fund and invest in VC.
Yep, I completely agree. So let's change gears a little bit. Let's go on the third part, which is actually my favorite. So let's get personal. I've seen on your actually Instagram that you've posted a couple of pictures, you know, with some philosophy books. So since you're a student of philosophy and then also mathematics and finance, what are the lessons learned from each of these areas of studies that have helped you as a founder?
Yeah, it's funny that you look at my Instagram. Essentially, it was a failed idea. I wanted to promote the concept of book porn, like food porn, but for books, right? Like to encourage people to read more and to learn more. It was a failure. So yeah, there are a couple of philosophy books on my Instagram. It's not something that I maintain anymore. Interesting question. So I don't think philosophy for sure will help to become a great entrepreneur. It's just because philosophy is so much about contemplation, you know, versus action. Mm-hmm. And entrepreneurship is all about action, right? There is not any contemplation. Finance, I think it helps a little bit. I think one of the best lessons is like accounting. Just to do your accounting in the first year, you need to understand debit credit. So that was great to have done, you know, this course at uni. But yeah, I mean, I'm not the first one, right, to have said that, but there is not like a, you know, university path that's going to teach you, you know, how to launch startups, right? Maybe religious studies, because you need to have faith. So you need to learn how to have faith in what you do, but that's the only thing I see really.
And what was the most challenging period in your founder journey so far, and how did you overcome it?
So yeah, when I presented the business, I took a shortcut. But essentially when we started, so release this landing page, the easiest way to launch your fund, and there were two options: hedge fund and crypto fund or VC fund. And when we launched, it was in 2018. So it was a peak of like, you know, crypto. So everyone wanted to launch a crypto fund, and we went down in that direction, like to really scale and automate crypto fund. So in 2 years, we structured more than 100 crypto funds. And with my co-founder a year and a half ago, we sat down and we were like, actually, how can we make this business, you know, big, right? And is it going to be crypto fund? And for a lot of different reasons, we didn't think it was, you know, it was the case. I think, for example, you know, Coinbase or Binance would be better suited, right, to launch like this kind of micro crypto fund because they have already the brokerage business. So we made that decision, like very hard decision, to completely pivot from crypto funds to VC, you know, VC funds and syndicate and SPV. And we had to deboard essentially all of our clients. So we lost like 80% of our revenue. So that was pretty tough. But it was amazing. Then with the right focus and all the team was on board, like it was really magic. Like in just 3 months, we recover all the revenue, you know, that we had lost, and we grew the company by 3x in the same year. So it was really, really like a roller coaster, but it worked out like handsomely.
And how did you take that hard decision? So you and your co-founder, you decided, should we do this? We're going to lose 80% of the revenue. Then you go to the team and you communicate, hey, we've decided to do this. Did you take like a week or two? Did you make a list with pros and cons? How did you take that decision?
It was really gut feeling. We are like, you know, this is the right thing to do. We discussed with like our, you know, first employee as well. Like, do you feel the same thing? You know, are we aligned? Like, do you feel it's the right call? It was like, yeah, I think, you know, it's like crypto fund, very difficult to scale. I don't think we can really, you know, win on the long term on that. So let's do it. And then, yeah, we communicated to the team and the reception was actually surprisingly good. So everyone was on board behind the new vision. And I think that's what, you know, allow us really to perform like really, really well this year.
Happy to hear. What is the best and worst advice that you have received?
So it's funny because last week, a friend of mine, like he's starting his startup and asked me, you know, for advice on how to get started, what should I do, etc. And honestly, I was completely lost, right? I didn't know where to start. Yeah, my only advice was to, you know, just do it. Just, you know, get started. And, you know, the entrepreneurship is as well to figure out, you know, stuff by yourself. And I think it's very important to learn by yourself, especially because with the internet, you can learn anything, right? I told him, like, I can only tell you my story, but that doesn't mean that it's going to work or doesn't work for you, right? Because every journey is unique, basically. So best advice I heard was to pick your battles, because essentially when you are in a startup, your default state is to be overwhelmed by a million things, right? So there are like fires everywhere, you know, on the tech side, on the sales, on operation, and you have limited time, right? So maybe the best you can do is this quarter, you're going to focus on tech, right? Like having a really good infrastructure and it's your focus for this quarter and you're going to let all the other fires burn, let it burn. And then next quarter, you're going to take care of it, right? But you can't extinguish, you know, all the fires at once because it's not going to work. So you need to, yeah, pick the right battle. And worst advice, I think it's more at the start. But someone, you know, told me like you need to find great mentors at the start, like to advise on, you know, on what to do, etc. And I was like, yeah, but you know, I know no one, right? I just came to London. I know, I know basically no one. So, am I supposed to find like all these mentors? And it's difficult as well to know if a mentor is actually good or like how you judge that. So yeah, I think mentors is important, but maybe at a later stage when it becomes like more strategic. For example, you know, right now there are 50 of us at the company. So how do we go from 50 to 100 and 150? And that's, you know, maybe at this stage where you need to be surrounded by, you know, founders and CEOs on how they manage this, the scale essentially. But at the start, you just need to focus on finding clients, building the product and just figure it out by yourself.
Got it. I don't remember which company it was, but apparently they had this red phone in the middle of the room and everyone in the team had to answer it maybe, you know, every other week. So everyone, you know, from, of course, like customer success, that maybe that was their job, but to the CEO, COO, because they really wanted to know what the customer needs and what's their problems. And I thought that it's just like very smart.
Exactly. I think it's super important.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think it's, is it Deliveroo that did it recently where everyone in the team has to ship one order to the client, even if you, and I think there was a head of engineering. He was like, yeah, I was, you know, I'm not paid like 400K to go on my, you know, motorbike to deliver. And he was like, yeah, everyone has to do it. That's what we do, right? That's the company mission.
Exactly. Tell me, what is your favorite book and the best book you read in the last 6 months?
So it's actually my favorite interview question that I ask candidates.
Oh, really?
It's funny that it's the same. Yeah, yeah. So favorite book all time, I have a few, but one that I really like, it's called Fully Automated Luxury Communism. And basically, it talks about the future of civilization in a world where, for example, we can mine asteroids. So there is no more problem of resources. In a world where there is no meat anymore, it's only lab-grown meat. So same, it solves the problem. In a world where we have figured out carbon capture, so there is no global warming anymore. And what are we going to do, right? If all of these problems are solved. And then he introduced this idea of it's like a new communism. So I can't comment on that, but it's getting too political. But I really like the book because, in the media and in the newspaper, you read all the time that the world is completely doomed and we never overcome global warming and we'll never overcome all these rare earth resources crisis problem, etc. But actually, you have a lot of people working on this hard problem, and technology has proven that it was possible, right? I remember reading this article where basically in the early 18th century or 19th century, there was an article on newspaper that London would completely be overwhelmed by horse shit because there were so many horses, and with the growth of the population, at some point there will be 2 meters of horse shit, and then someone invented the car, right? So and there was not this problem anymore. I feel sometimes with newspaper, etc., there is a lot of negativity. So I think it's a great book to remind ourselves that there is there is light, right? There is hope. And last 6 months, I really just finished it's called The Culture Map by Erin Meyer. And essentially, everyone is talking about how important is it to work with people from diverse background, different countries, etc. But her point is that to be able to work with people from everywhere in the world, you need to accept their differences between culture that truly exist, right? It's not just a myth. For example, in France, it's not rude if you arrive at a meeting 5 minutes late, but in the UK or in Germany, it's the end of the world. You need to be on time. So when you work with a team of German people and French people, if they don't accept their own cultures, then it's going to create friction. Or for example, another funny example: in France, it's supposed to be a very indirect culture versus the American that is very direct, right, and business oriented. But there is only one exception with that. It's when you provide feedback.
Yeah,
exactly. You know it, right? That performance review. Because feedback from French people are very, very, very tough and direct. And feedback from American are really soft, right? So they're going to wrap it into a lot of positivity. But if you don't know that, then there could be a lot of misinterpretation and miscommunication. So I think it's a book, honestly, all startups that works in especially with a work from home, if I work remotely, etc. All startups that work with different people from different countries have to read this book because it's key.
Yeah, no. I don't know if you knew, but Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, read this book, and then he went to Erin and he said, "Hey, help me write No Rules Rule book."
Oh my God.
Yeah, so I don't know if you know that. So Netflix, they have offices all over the world, right? And he saw this problem and he was like, how can we integrate actually the Netflix culture, right? Because in the end, the company has one culture. And then when you start to hire globally, the company's culture has to also permeate, right? Or to integrate in a very nice way with, the culture of other countries. So
of other countries, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, hey, why don't you come and kind of help me write this book? So no, it was very interesting. I read both books. I can recommend you also the book No Rules Rule by Reed Hastings. It's very, very good. Tell me about a person that had an impact on your life.
For sure, it was our first client. without him, I don't think we would be here talking.
Shout out to the first client here, from Ulrich. And if Ulrich from now would meet Ulrich from 5 years ago, what would you tell him?
It's funny because I used to do the opposite, where I would send myself, messages in the future on my calendar. like 6 months ago, I woke up and saw an alert on my, you know, on my phone, on my calendar that I had planned, like when I started the company. And it said, I hope you have done your seed round by then.
love it.
Yeah, no, so sure. I do the opposite. I mean, to answer the question, I don't know. I think I would just, you know, keep it simple, like just keep going. Just have faith and keep going.
Keep going and have faith. Love it. Ulrich, thank you very much for taking the time. Very much appreciated.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
It was.